lecture is to kind of continue on, but to move away from either sort of reviewing the mathematics. We've sort of developed a little bit of a toolbox and to show how we actually, in practice, use it. So I'm going to focus on a very important physical example, but also one that's relatively straightforward to demonstrate computationally, because, you know, usually it wants to become fluent in the techniques, you've actually got to try them for yourself, but it's helpful, again, to see just how you proceed with that. So we're going to apply this Cartan formalism and the structural equations to calculating the curvature of the metric around a star. So you've got the handout, because there's, you know, quite a bit of algebra that we go through. And it's also got a little bit more detail than I'm actually going to sort of explicitly cover. So the idea is that our physical problem is that we look, you know, at the universe or the galaxy around us, and we see there's lots of objects that are roughly spherically symmetric, gravitating, and essentially static, at least to a very good approximation. So these are stars. So that's what we're going to look at. And, you know, you've seen this already in the first GR course. You probably had a go at computing the curvature. But I want to try and convince you that Cartan is a kind of a nice, efficient way of doing it and somewhat less prone to errors. So the first part of the handout, which is the bit I'm not going to cover in detail, discusses how you translate statements about symmetry into properties of your metric. So when you first met the Lie derivative, I'm guessing that you sort of saw that it was related to things called Killing vectors, which told you about symmetries of the metric. So it tells you when the metric has a certain operation or something that you do on your space-time, which leaves the distance function invariant. So if we ask ourselves, what is the basic feature about, say, our sun? Well, it's basically spherical. So mathematically, we would translate that into an SO3 symmetry. And it's been more or less the same, so that's hence the static bit. Now, of course, it's not completely true, but it's true for our purposes. So SO3 symmetry means that we have Killing vectors that have an SO3 algebra. And so the first part of the handout just shows in sort of gory detail how we translate that into reducing the degrees of freedom of our metric, because our metric is a symmetric bilinear form. That means it has 10, in general, independent components, which is quite a lot to keep track of. So always, whenever we're looking for solutions in GR, we're always looking for ways to simplify our problem. And so symmetry is a real help in that case. So all of this together means that our line element reduces to this form. So the SO3 bit is showing up here. It means that we can take angular coordinates that look like, give us something that's a multiple of the metric on the unit 2 sphere. The fact that it's static is kind of showing up in this part, saying that we only really see a dt squared. We've got this time symmetry, and everything only depends on this radial coordinate r. Now, at the moment, the A, B, and C, so we've reduced 10 functions to 3, there's still a redundancy because I can choose my radial coordinate to sort of change what B is or to choose it for example, to set what C is. So at the moment, there's a slight redundancy in this expression, but I'm just going to leave it there just for the sake of, you know, sake of argument in the sense of talking about different gauges that might be useful. So what we're going to do is we're going to use this whole Cartan sort of methodology that I derived yesterday to compute the curvature of this metric and then go and talk about its solutions. So in order to use Cartan, I need to think about what, you know, what the process was that we talked about yesterday. So the first thing that I proved was that the symmetric part of the connection was equal to the exterior derivative of the components of G in whatever the basis was. So I said if we chose an orthonormal basis, then dg ab was zero, so we had an antisymmetric connection. So that's our first step, is to find an orthonormal basis, and then, of course, to take its exterior derivative. So an orthonormal basis means we want to pick off one form such that the components of the metric in that basis are either plus or minus one. And because we've got block diagonal metric, it's actually really easy to spot what they are in this case. Because if I take omega t to be a dt, then you see that this is just omega t, this first piece. So we simply read off those four basis vectors, covectors. So that's relatively straightforward to identify. And then we just need to take D of each of these. So in terms of D omega T, well, A is a function of R, so it's D of A wedge DT. So that's A prime dr wedge dt. And then I want to write this in terms of the orthonormal basis itself. So if I want to turn dr into omega r, I have to have a BdR, so hence the 1 over B. To turn my dt into an omega t, I have to take omega t divided by A. Mm-hmm.
Why do you put hat on the...
Right, yes, I was just about to say that. The reason I'm putting hat will actually only become completely obvious at the very end, but the reason is I want to emphasize that this is an orthonormal basis. So hat sort of emphasizes this. Because normally when you write, say, you know, psi t, we have this subconscious tendency to say that is a coordinate component. So I'm putting hats on to kind of keep myself honest. And so to remind myself that this is components. You know, this is an orthonormal basis, and so these are telling you about this different basis, not the coordinate basis. So that's what that's about. And then d omega r is obviously zero because b is a function of r. OK. Okay, that's not the button I press, but never mind. So, it's obviously having a bad day. Right, so that's two, that's half of my job done. So let me just finish off, d omega theta. And I hope I hattered the R there. Yeah. Is therefore minus C prime over CB, omega theta wedge omega R, and d omega phi d omega phi has two pieces because of the sine theta in there, and so I get something that's similar to the d omega theta term from differentiating C with respect to R, but then I also have to differentiate the sine theta. And so when I turn everything back into an expression in the orthonormal basis, I get that cot theta over C. So next, I want to use Cartan's first equation. In the absence of torsion, it tells me that d omega a is minus theta ab wedge omega b. So this really reduces finding the connection to an algebraic problem now that I've done the differentiation. So here I haven't sort of gone through looking at individual components and then computing the various non-zero parts of the connection. I've kind of packaged everything, as Cartan tells me to, into this basis. I've done this exterior differentiation, which in this case is kind of easy. And then the various components are all sort of sitting there for me to just peel off. So that was why I reordered things, say, in that d omega t, to put the omega t first. Because if I look here at my Cartan equation and say, well, let me ask what happens if I make that a t hat here, well, then that tells me it's theta t hat r hat cross omega r hat plus theta t hat cross omega theta hat, etc. Now, since there's only an omega t cross an omega r on the right-hand side up there, it tells me that the only piece here is a t hat r hat. So the only non-zero term is that one. So the other t hat theta hat, t hat phi hat vanish, and there's no t hat because this is anti-symmetric in it, because we've chosen an orthonormal basis. So again, I can read off all these other ones. And I end up reading off those four different non-zero connection components. So I've now finished computing my connection. So the next step is to compute the curvature. And I do this using that Cartan's second equation. So I'll do the first one in slightly more detail. If I look at TR, this is what Cartan's second equation tells me. I've got to take D of the relevant connection one form, and then I've got to look at the theta wedge theta pieces. Now, if I look at the theta wedge theta pieces, the only non-zero connection one form with a T hat in it is T hat R hat, but then that would mean this A was an R hat, so this would give me R hat here, which is zero. So that term does not contribute. And all I'm left with is taking the exterior derivative of this thing here. But my omega t is a dt. So this is d of a primed on b dt, which is a primed on b primed the r wedge dt, which is therefore minus 1 on ab, a primed on b primed, omega t cross omega r. So that's the first curvature 2 form calculated. Now, there are going to be 6 in general, because it's anti-symmetric. So what about t theta? Well, there's no connection one form, t theta, but again, I have to look at the cross terms here. So if this is non-zero, it would have to be tr, because that's the only non-zero connection one form with a t in it, and then r theta. So what is this quantity here? Well, remember that the connection, if I lower that index, the connection is anti-symmetric. So if I can just put in a different color, just a line of reasoning here. If I lower my R index, I do that using eta AB. So this is equal to minus theta R hat theta hat, having lowered that index. I then change the ordering of my theta and R, which gives me a minus sign because the connection is anti-symmetric. And I then raise the theta index, which gives me another minus sign because I use the convention plus, minus, 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 and I'm just guessing that that's probably not what you've seen. So if I now read off what those are, I get A primed on AB and C primed on CB, omega T cross omega theta. And then the same argument with the phi, using a phi index instead of a theta index, also works. So I'm actually halfway there already. Let me just finish the job. Theta R, this is going to be D of this thing. So this is very similar to the calculation of R T hat R hat. So that's D of C primed on B D theta, which is then going to be minus C primed on B primed 1 on CB, omega theta cross omega R. So it's a very similar argument to the very first one that I did, except Instead of t, we have theta, and instead of a, we've got c. Slightly more effort doing the phi term. Because now I have a potential cross term from the theta wedge theta piece. So here I pick up first of all, I take the derivative with respect to R. Then I take the derivative with respect to theta. And then I've got to take this cross term. So here, that's this piece. And then the theta R is that. But now, if I look at these two terms here in a bit more detail, here I've got things that look more like your coordinate basis, d theta, d phi. Here I've got things in my orthonormal basis, but I know that this is c sine theta d phi. So this first term just reduces to cos theta d phi. And the second term, we know omega theta is c d theta, so this reduces to c primed on b d theta. So this term here is actually minus that term there, because here we've got a d theta d phi, and here a d phi d theta. So those two terms actually cancel, and what we end up with is just something that looks quite familiar. So to finish the job, I do the final curvature 2 form. So my phi theta is cos theta d phi, and I replace the connection one forms in the final wedge product. Okay, so I've now finished my calculation, and what I've actually got, it's slightly encoded, but I've now found the curvature of my general line element. So what I now need to do is simply read off the Riemann curvature. From the definition of the curvature 2 form. So, having calculated this, I simply look at my expressions here for the curvature 2 form, and I just peel off my Riemann tensor. So the first one, my RTR, I see that the TR, curvature 2 form, is just got a single piece, which is omega T cross omega R. So that tells me about, that's why I pick these two indices here. And then what is the value of it? Well, I just literally transport that one on AB, A primed on B primed. And then I carry on. The T theta has, again, only a single term. So I just write that down here. And that's A prime C prime on AB squared C. And that's actually the same as the T phi component. So I've now peeled those Riemanns off from that sort of middle board there. So if I look at the other piece, I now got theta R, there's again only one term in that. And it's the same as the phi R piece. So that's dealt with the left-hand side of that board. And finally, I just read off the angular pieces there. So that is my Riemann tensor. The only proviso being that it's in an orthonormal basis. So that was your question right at the very beginning, is just to be aware that this is not a coordinate basis, and usually we're used to doing things in a coordinate basis. But in this whole process, I've now computed the Riemann tensor of that metric. So it's a reasonably straightforward process, and I can now be confident that I've calculated the only non-zero pieces. So I haven't had to go through checking index by index and component by component, seeing, is this, you know, what is this? Is it zero? Is it not zero? If it's not zero, what is it? So at all points, I've been able to keep tabs on what the non-zero pieces are. So it's kind of quite an efficient way of doing it. So since we're used to doing things in a coordinate basis, so we want to transform our orthonormal basis to a coordinate basis. And what we do there is we simply use the components of our orthonormal basis in the coordinate basis. So here I'm using the fact that if I have a geometrical quantity Q, which I could write as QA hat B hat, EA omega b, so that would be in my orthonormal basis. In my coordinate basis, this would be q mu nu d by dx mu tensor dx nu. So that's my orthonormal versus my coordinate basis. So these two things have to be the same because q is a geometric object. So that means I can relate my components q by writing my E, my basis vector E, as EA mu d by dx mu, and my covector basis, omega A, as omega A nu dx nu. So this is in essence, when we do an orthonormal basis, we're kind of almost taking a square root of the metric in a sense, because we're sort of finding these components of our basis vectors. So for example, when we first identified our orthonormal basis, if I look at omega t, it's only got a dt piece. So I just have an omega t hat t being the A of R. So from this, I can read off my Riemann And so I've kind of got to the end of my hard work here, having computed the Riemann tensor of this metric. So I guess in this particular instance, this has sort of gone into it in quite gory detail, but one of the things that as you work with doing this sort of computation is you start to spot patterns. So you can start to see how to kind of use building blocks, piecing together different parts, sort of space times, or build, here we've got a block diagonal space, so you could view it as being like the two-sphere part times a TR piece. And so, this allows you to sort of patch together more sort of steadily more and more complex space times, but to do it in a way that, where you can sort of, without getting into too deep algebraic waters, you can just go ahead and compute the curvature of quite general metrics, without having to specify the number of dimensions or the exact details of maybe, there's some sort of part or some subset of the dimensions have a fixed geometry, like in this case, the theta phi parts of the metric have a fixed geometry. It's a two-sphere. So that's where this method comes into its own, when you want to do things that are sort of slightly more general structurally, rather than looking at a sort of very specific problem. However, what I wanted to do today was to address a very specific problem, which was to actually try and apply this whole process to finding out, exploring what the metric of a star is. Now, you've seen the Schwarzschild metric, but let's actually just look at it, again from this perspective. So here I said right at the beginning that I put in a bit of redundancy in the metric to sort of see, to be a bit more agnostic about what gauge I wanted to choose. So I could choose various different gauges to simplify my problem. I could, if I wanted to, choose b equals 1, which would mean that r was proper distance. In the radial direction. Now, I'm not going to do that, but maybe there are instances where that is a very useful gauge to choose. I could choose B as 1 over A, which I could call a Schwarzschild gauge, in which case C would have to remain a general function. So this is sometimes a useful gauge, depending on what the Einstein equations look like. So when people were first looking at four-dimensional black holes in sort of string theory type of gravity, this was a gauge that was particularly useful. The one that you're most used to is C equals R, which we call the area gauge, because in this gauge, the area of the two spheres is 4 pi r squared. Now that r is not proper distance. It's simply telling you about the area of the two spheres. But it is the one that we most commonly use. So let's just have a look at what happens if we put c equal to r. So if I look at those Ricci tensor components, every time you see a C, you should replace it with R. So C primed is 1, C double primed is 0. And obviously, each time we see the C, we just put an R. So if I calculate my Einstein tensor, the C double prime vanishes, and my GTT now only has first derivatives. So here I've got 1 over R squared. Here I've also got 1 over R squared, but there's a 1 over B squared outside. And then I've got a B primed on B. So I can rebadge that second bit into the derivative of R over B squared. So this has to equal 8 pi g t naught naught by Einstein's equations. So that tells me that the derivative of r over b squared is 1 minus r squared t naught naught, more or less. So I can formally integrate this up. So just let me write this formally at the moment. And I've got at least implicitly a solution that should look very familiar. I haven't made any assumptions yet about whether we're in vacuum or not. This is always going to be true. The question is, how do we interpret that integral? So if we were nearly in flat space or very weak gravity, we would see that, well, this 4 pi r squared is the area of the two sphere. So 4 pi r squared t naught naught dr is like the amount of energy, in the sense of T naught naught, that lies between R and R plus dr. So this whole thing together, this integral, we want to interpret as the total mass that lies inside a radius R. So we find ourselves wanting to write this as M of R. Now, I'm perfectly free to define that as a function M of R, but it's going back to a sort of weak field limit, then this would be what we would intuitively associate as the mass inside a shell of radius R. So that's, again, making sense that this is R b to the minus 2. If I go right back to the beginning and look what appeared up in that metric up there, it's saying that independent of the pressure, independent of my source, if I just look at the spatial part of the metric and put choose area gauge so that I've got an R squared in front of that d omega piece, then my B function, my B squared, the sort of dr squared part of it is dr squared divided by 1 minus 2gm over R. So that's kind of, you know, tying in very nicely with a Schwarzschild solution, but I haven't really said anything about what is sourcing this gravitational field, if anything is indeed. So if we were in vacuum, then we wouldn't necessarily have this term here at all, but what we would have potentially is an integration constant. So in that case, we would get something that looked very familiar, 1 minus 2gm on R. We'd then say, to finish our story, we'd look at our Einstein equation. And so in vacuum, this would vanish. Should be 1 over R there. So here, I see that in vacuum, my A primed on A is actually essentially the same as minus B primed on B, and so I end up with the Schwarzschild solution, which you've all seen. But what happens if we're not in vacuum? What do we get? Let's actually think about the problem of finding the metric of a star. So let's go back to that radial equation there. So instead of writing m as a constant, I'm now writing my m of r function. So that's what I get in general. So what I'm going to do now is to derive a different equation for A in terms of the pressure and this mass function, m of r, and then see whether we can actually find a solution for it in maybe a simple model for a star.
You mean Tolman-Oppenheimer?
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. Did you do that in?
Yes.
Before. Oh.
No, it's fine.
No, did you do it in the GR?
No, I am.
Oh, you've done it. Okay, right. That's fine. I was suddenly thinking, you know, no, because normally you don't. Yeah. So this is, as we say, what I'm about to talk about is this was first looked at by Tolman, Oppenheimer, and Volkoff in terms of trying to model the interior of a star. You did do it.
Yeah, but Yes.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't actually in the lectures, but you've done it in the. Found the solution for P of R.
Yes.
Okay.
We can.
Right, sure. So then perhaps it's not such a good thing to carry on and discuss.
We can see a quick sketch or. I'll complete Mr. Rivera.
Okay, well, I'll quickly, then if you've done it, there's no point in sort of going into it in detail. So in this case, you're basically sort of using energy conservation to find out the properties of M of R. So the only thing I'll write down, which may be slightly different to what you actually saw, is in this case, I want to write, given that I haven't computed my connection coefficients in the coordinate basis, I want to use what I've just computed here. And so I have to do this in the orthonormal basis. So the idea is that we take an isotropic perfect fluid and so the components of T are basically going to be that T naught naught is rho and Tij, the spatial components, are going to be P delta ij. So that's the sort of idea. And so in this case, all I wanted to sort of remark on then is how you would read off your connection from what we just computed. So here, if I look about components that have an A, remember the connection one forms were the connection components contracted with the base covector basis on this first index. So here, if we have, for example, have I just gone and got rid of them all? No, I haven't. Here we've got theta t hat r hat tells me that my gamma t t r is a primed on a b, for example. So here, this is p r prime, so p primed on b. So I simply read off my connection components from this thing here. And just remember that it's in an orthonormal basis, so you're going to get the odd 1 over r or 1 over a or whatever coming in. So I think given that you've actually done this, I don't think there's much point in going through the details, but hopefully, you can tell me if you didn't get this, what you did was modeled the density profile with a top hat function, is that correct? Did you do that?
Because we did it in homework and we do not discuss homeworks later, we did not actually go to its interpretation. We just did the assignment.
Okay. Because, I mean, this is the problem, you know, I don't get to know what hands up if you've done the assignment. So you've done this with the top hat profile.
No profile.
No profile.
Just finding your formula and submitting it.
David, do you know what the homework was?
I have no idea. I think you can carry on.
Right. Well, no, it's just there's no point if they've done the whole thing in detail. It's just, you know, I've no idea what was done. So,
last point in the assignment, what you arrived is this Oppenheimer formula, but what to do, what that formula
okay, is. Well, let's see. Anyway, so I was going to model a star with what we call a top hat. Density profile, which means that the density is fixed inside the star and zero outside the star. Okay, so that's the density profile, and it's called a top hat because it kind of looks like that. So this means our M of R increases, obviously, inside the star as we move out, and then it is a constant outside the star. And then we could call that constant capital M. So now I'm going to use the conservation of energy momentum to write down a differential equation for P. And I now know what my function M of R is in terms of this constant density rho naught and the actual function of the radial variable. So inside the star, so my M of R inside the star goes like R cubed. So on the top line, I've got a common factor of R cubed that I can pull out. And on the bottom line, I've got, again, this known function of R. So I end up with here a slightly messy looking differential equation for the pressure profile. So rho naught's a constant and everything's a function of R. So this is what Tolman, Oppenheimer and Volkoff did. And you may or may not have done. I'm still not quite sure what you have done. So. So One of the surprising things is that this has actually got an exact analytic solution. And one that I can never remember offhand, so I've always got to write it down. So that's our solution for the pressure profile. So I invite you. So does this look familiar?
So the last thing we did was finding that formula, but
I see. So that
everything
was
after that.
Okay, right. So in this case, so you didn't see this before, right? So it's one of the things that you notice, I think, if you go back a century, because there were no computers, people were sort of seemed to be rather sort of crafty at finding analytic solutions of rather unpromising looking differential equations. So I must admit, when I look at this, I just sort of think, how did they get that? Anyway, so this is the profile for the pressure. And if we look at what happens as we go to the edge of the star, where this R here goes to capital R, then the bottom line remains finite, but the top line actually tends to zero. So that's how the integration constants have been chosen. So P tends to zero as R tends to R, because our pressure kind of has to have a sensible profile. We can't have a sort of non-zero pressure at the outside of the star, otherwise matter would want to sort of shed off. So P at R equals zero, on the other hand, has a finite value. Now, you've looked at the Schwarzschild solution, so you're very well aware that there's an issue at R equals 2gm, but what you see here is there's also an issue as R tends to 9gm on 4. So that happens outside, capital R is 2gm. So P becomes infinite if you actually look at what happens when R is 9/4 gm. This square root is square root of a ninth, and so you end up with 1 minus 1 on the bottom line. So what this is kind of indicating is that for a given density, there's kind of a limit to how big the star can be. So our limit, if we kind of go back, we're sort of saying that for a given density, we can't make the star too big. Otherwise, things go drastically wrong. Now, it's only a simple model, top hat, constant density. You could say, okay, that's very idealized. Yes, it is. On the other hand, this is an analytic argument that we can do on the blackboard. And what it's giving us is it's giving us a clue that we can't make things as big as we like. There's kind of something that goes wrong. So it's the first sort of indicator of what we would now call a Chandrasekhar limit. We know that if we can, for example, provide a realistic limit on density by thinking of sort of nuclear forces or indeed the strong force, then we're sort of starting to get this notion that there's a limit to how big we can make stars. Now, it's naive, but it is analytic, and it's kind of giving us a clue that it's worth going back to the problem and trying to do it properly, which is, of course, what Chandrasekhar did back in the 1930s. So if something's big enough and heavy enough, it will form a black hole. So that's kind of leading us on to what we'll do next. Sorry, yes, you had a question.
Yes, as I said, also for small density because your equation for the metric Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkov is three sets of equations.
Yeah.
For the metric one, I mean, it's very hard to solve for big density. I mean,
yes, it's very, that's what, I mean, it is absolutely, I mean, for sure, it's idealized. We've said top hat profile, criticize that, right? Isotropic perfect fluid, we can criticize that. There's a lot of holes we can pick in the argument, but what it is it's an exact analytic argument. And so that is the purpose of it. It's when you try things, you always try the easiest thing first and then see if that informs you. If the easiest thing is nice and self-consistent, then it's a sort of bit of a sign that you've got something right. If the easiest thing points you to something that could be a contradiction or a singularity, then that tells you, okay, I've got to go back and try this again and try and do it a bit more realistically. Sometimes doing things more realistically solves the problem. Other times, like the black hole information paradox, it doesn't seem to get us all that far. Okay, so that's the logic behind it. Do the simplest thing first and see what it informs you. In this case, it's informing us that there could be a problem with trying to build stars that are too big. And of course, we kind of all know the popular history of that. We know there is a problem with trying to build stars too big. Even if we try and do it in, you know, the most sophisticated way possible, there's always a limit. We cannot make a star too big. So.